Alex Lemon was known by his nickname, Happy, when he was a freshman in college. He was popular, social, the star catcher on the baseball team, and he lived the carefree and hard-partying life of a typical 18-year-old. And then, in 1997, during the spring term of his freshman year, Alex suffered the first of a series of debilitating strokes that brought him face-to-face with his own mortality. In his new memoir, Happy, he chronicles his deteriorating health, his ever-increasing abuse of drugs and alcohol to cope with it, and the combination of a miraculous surgery and the emotional support that saved his life. I'm very pleased to welcome Alex Lemon to our show today. Hello.
Hi. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
We often think of a stroke as something seismic that renders you unable to walk or talk. What were your symptoms?
My brain bleed was felt in a way where I had numbness on the right side of my face and in my hand, nystagmus, which means my eyes were bouncing, and a slight diplopia, so double vision.
And yet you ignored it?
I think many young men, I did not want to talk about my feelings. I didn't want to seem like I was scared or hurt or wounded.
And you didn't go to a doctor for a couple of weeks?
For 2 weeks.
Really, that long? It must have been difficult just
getting around.
To get through.
Getting around was a challenge, but I did not want to confront that fear. That's something, as an 18-year-old who was seemingly invincible in so many ways, did not want to confront that the fear of my own mortality, that something could be wrong.
Well, did you even suspect that it was a stroke? How common are strokes among 18-year-olds?
I have no clue. I know, you know, vascular malformations affect a small portion of the population, and it's even a smaller number where the malformations bleed. I thought I was hungover, or that, you know, the symptoms I was feeling were just a result of something I had done at night, let's say.
So what finally prompted you to go to the college health clinic?
My girlfriend at the time was pretty adamant about going to see someone because my symptoms weren't getting better.
And what did they diagnose you as having?
At first, health services thought I had an inner ear infection, which I think a lot of young people who are suffering brain problems have.
And, well, you feel dizzy when you have inner ear problems.
You know, vertigo problems, problems with their eyesight. But they were really good and made sure that I saw a doctor, and the doctor thought it was still an inner ear infection, but was adamant about me seeing a neurologist. And the neurologist told me that next morning that I needed to go to the hospital.
But the doctor told you that it's unlikely that the malformation in your brain stem would result in any further bleeding, so you must have felt reassured.
I was split, that I was reassured that it wasn't going to happen again, but it felt like there was some sort of time bomb inside me.
But still, you returned to your former life.
I did.
And you playing sports, kept going, seeing your girlfriend, you took drugs, you drank.
I immersed myself in a life that made me feel normal and pushed that to the limits so I could ignore how I felt inside, you know, that I was depressed, that I was sad and scared and wounded.
You describe it as trying to breaststroke through oatmeal.
Yeah, I mean, the days.
So what was happening in class? Were you able to focus, to concentrate?
I mean, I was a mediocre student for a number of years. I would show up sometimes. I was shy. I think that, you know, the manifestation of my depression kind of sunk me into a hole where I wouldn't talk.
And you were self-medicating, doing a lot of partying, sometimes gargling in the morning with flat beer from the night before. You called one episode the Feast of Forgetting to be Afraid.
Yeah, the only way that I did not think about what was wrong with me or what it meant to be a survivor of sexual abuse was to medicate myself.
So you'd had an earlier problem, the sexual abuse, which was something else that you had also been pushing away, ignoring or denying?
Exactly. So already I felt different from the crowd I was trying to immerse myself in. And then I felt doubly different because now I had this medical trauma too.
When were you sexually abused? How old were
I was 4 years old by a teenage cousin.
Mm-hmm. Did you believe that your stroke was a one-time thing, or did you sense that there was something that might be more seriously wrong with you?
I felt like something was seriously wrong with me, that it was this sign of impending doom, that I was bound to fail in life.
Although nothing seriously happened until the arrival of a brand new Trek bicycle.
Yes.
What happened with that?
For two years, I did. I lived that carefree life in college. And then I bought a bicycle in Roseville, which was 15 miles or so north of where I went to college. And I was riding back, and I felt that malformation bleeding again. And
so for
and
2 years,
right away,
you were in just kind of like sliding through?
Yeah. I was doing whatever I could to not think about what was wrong with me.
And you hadn't been seeing doctors all along?
Occasionally. I was getting an MRI. I was had got second opinions, second and third opinions about what was wrong with me. And everybody had the same opinion that the chances of it bleeding again were so small that it wasn't worth doing anything about.
Because you were young.
Because I was young, and because it's rare that they bleed.
But then you realized you did need to have brain surgery.
After the incident on the Trek and the spot, the malformation had grown to a degree that if it kept bleeding, doctors were worried about quality of life issues and would I make it to be 30 years old. And I realized that I did have to have surgery.
I asked you before whether this is a common thing, 18-year-olds having strokes. You must have heard from some people after the book was published or when you have done book signings. Have other people come up to you and said, I had a similar experience? Or are you a real rarity?
No, I have. I have on a number of different levels. I've had young people who have had medical trauma, who have had similar brain bleeds because of vascular malformations, and which is rare. And so I think it can be an incredibly moving story for them. But I've also had doctors who are interested in the God part of the brain contact me. And then I've also had young men and their mothers contact me, which I find the most profoundly moving.
Well, we'll get into the whole matter of your mother in this story in just a moment. My guest is Alex Lemon, who teaches at Texas Christian University. He's author of three collections of poetry and the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. And now he's written a memoir called Happy. You decided to have your surgery in Miami. Is that where the best brain surgeons are?
Well, I had actually decided on a neurosurgeon at the University of Minnesota, and at the last minute, he told me that he thought I would be in better hands if I saw someone else. And as a 21-year-old, of course, that meant I was going to die, that nobody wanted to deal with me. But in hindsight, as an adult, I'm so appreciative of that honesty. And I ended up going to Miami because his mentor was teaching there. And he had, of all the neurosurgeons around, he was more familiar with the situation.
Although you arrived not long after Hurricane Floyd. Did that affect the ability of the hospital to do this kind of surgery?
Well, yes. My surgery was planned and was postponed because Hurricane Floyd was supposed to hit and people were leaving Miami. The hospital was shut down. My family and I were stuck in a hotel room that, was surrounded by people boarding up their buildings and with the TV of people fleeing Miami.
And you said you'd already had to come to grips with a sense of mortality while you were recovering from your surgery in the ICU. A boy your age was admitted and later died from injuries that he sustained from a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, that was really the beginning of this kind of immersion in this world where I was continually confronting the fallibility of the body.
Had you had any of the kinds of things we associate with stroke? Were you aphasic ever? Did you lose the use of one side?
I have had paresthesia and neuralgia, you know, so numbness and tingling. But cognitively, I've been sharp. And other than having mush mouth sometimes when I'm tired, not being able to articulate very well, I've felt incredibly lucky about my disability.
So you walk normally?
I have a slight, I veer to my right. My gait is slightly off.
I know some people who've never had a stroke who do that too. So how long did it take to recover from the brain surgery?
I don't think there is a beginning and an end. I think I will be living with it every day of my life. You know, I can't see very well, and I kind of stutter step when I walk. And
are these side effects of the surgery, or the fact that you took so long to have the surgery?
I think a combination of both. The bleeding and the surgery having to go through good tissue.
You mentioned mothers. Your mother plays a major role in your recovery. Had you been close before?
Yes. You know, my mother is the hero of the book. And that, I think, is the most prominent narrative, is the my relationship with her. We'd been close. She raised me by herself. But as somebody who wanted to be the all-American boy, I kind of reacted to her artistic, fringish lifestyle. And we were close, but in a very volatile sort of way.
But in this case, she forces you to do your exercises,
yeah.
Keeps on your tail for your rehab.
Everything. I owe everything to her.
You think she saved your life?
I think she has made my life amazing in so many ways that I could never repay that debt that I owe her.
You went back to your college in your wheelchair for a Saturday football game. How did your friends react to seeing you in that situation?
Well, I think, like most young people faced with issues of mortality, they didn't know what to think. You know, some of them joked about taking me out to clubs and using me to pick up girls. Some of the young men.
Because you were so pathetic?
Yeah, right? I mean, like bringing a puppy to the park. some people made fun of me because that's, in so many ways, that's how many young men are compassionate towards each other. You know, that I didn't know how to articulate my real feelings and love for other young men. And so there was that continuation of being picked on, teasing. And I was hyper aware of how different I was than from all of them.
When did you realize that you were going to have to send your mother back home?
I think I was having so much alone time and thinking about my life and thinking about if I really wanted to go on. I mean, beyond like physically being capable to go on, but just dealing with my depression and mental illness, wanting to go on in life. And if I wanted to do that, I was going to have to cut that tether. So once I kind of realized that I did want to prolong it a little bit, I realized that she was going to have to go home.
On the other hand, you were made again and again aware of how vulnerable you were.
Mm-hmm.
You tell the story of walking one night in the dark with your cane.
Yeah.
What happened?
One of my friends was driving by, and because I can't see very well, you know, after waiting to cross the street and nobody stopping for someone with a cane, one of my friends was driving by and was picking on me in a way that I know in hindsight was compassionate and filled with love.
He was teasing you.
He was teasing me. You know, he was pretending to be somebody else, pretending like he was going to mug me or something.
That's hilarious.
And, I mean, in hindsight, it was. But as a handicapped young man, like trying to get home in the snow, it was incredibly scary.
Well, I think it was in poor taste even then. But
I love him.
Toward the end of your rehab, your mother handed you a quote from Voltaire.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that?
Paradise is where I am.
And you said that you were going to have it tattooed. Well, you are covered in tattoos, but I don't see any words. Oh, you put it on your back?
It's right down my spine. And I have some poems.
Is this when you started being tattooed, or were you already into it before you had the stroke?
I really started getting a lot of them after rehab because it was the only way I could physically control my body. You know, so much of my body was under someone else's control. I was falling down. I couldn't see. But I could choose to mark my body in any way I wanted, and in a way that's socially acceptable instead of self-abuse.
But it's interesting that you were a jock and you said not a particularly good student, and here you are now teaching English at Texas Christian University, the author of three collections of poetry, the sort of thing that jocks make fun of.
Now
a memoir.
I was a complicated person and remain a complicated person. That I'm happy this jockish, happy character was just a mask and a sliver of who I actually was. That I was interested and invested in the arts and in so much beyond that, the kind of masculine ideal.
But you gave up all of those other things. Stop playing baseball, obviously.
Well, I couldn't physically do those things.
And but the drugs?
Yeah, I'm clean and sober.
Because it actually would make you more vulnerable, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard enough sometimes.
The day is hard enough. I mean, I'm, for the most, you know, I know how to cope. I know how to deal with my disability and my depression. But that doesn't mean every day is easy and that it's not a challenge to do things.
On the other hand, it may also make you feel a bit invincible.
Wait, the drugs or
No. The fact that you've come through all of this and you're relatively unscathed considering everything that happened.
I don't think I think maybe for some people that would feed this idea of being invincible, but for me it's given me just an awareness of the world around me and a sensitivity to it.
So you've written a memoir.
Yeah.
Does this mean you're going to continue writing prose as well?
Well, I have a book of poems coming out in March, Fancy Beasts, and then I am working on a new collection of poems in dialogue with Emerson's Essay on Beauty and another memoir.
Alex Lemon will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Book Court in Brooklyn. And his book is called Happy. It is published by Scribner. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.